Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Urban agriculture allows a dialogue between the generations, which I think we've also been missing in North America for a very long time.
Jennifer Cockrell King explored urban farms all over the world for her book Food and the City, a conversation with her in today's show. The latest in the battle over labels on foods containing GMOs, that's from Harvest Public Media. Two salads on Chef Daniel Orr's menu. One uses bread you'd probably normally toss in the compost pile, and the other has raw okra in it. Then we take a visit to a new farm to get a lesson in hydroponics and tips for cultivating a loyal customer base. What's happening in the world of food? News stories with Mark Chilla.
This week, an Ohio judge struck down a law that criminalized undercover recordings of farms and ranches. As Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, that could put similar laws in a handful of other states in jeopardy.
Most ag-gag laws, as they're called, are designed to prevent animal rights groups from secretly videotaping large-scale dairy, poultry, and hog farms. They're usually looking for instances of abuse. The Idaho judge said the state's law was unconstitutional. In the wake of the ruling, University of Denver law professor Justin Marceau says states with this type of law on the books should expect to be sued. And he says the judge's decision could keep other states from considering their own ag gag laws.
Now, if you're passing one of these laws, you're staring down the barrel of a precedent that says this stuff does violate the First Amendment.
The Idaho Attorney General has yet to file an appeal. Agricultural groups in the state say they'll support one. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
In case you missed it last week, Ahold USA became the largest conventional grocer in the United States to join the Coalition of Immokalee Workers Fair Food Program. The program protects farm workers' rights, including fair wages, safety compliance, and protection against sexual harassment. By agreeing to join the Fair Food Program, Ahold's 780 supermarkets across 14 states will only do business with suppliers that meet CIW's criteria. Walmart agreed last year to pay 1 more cent per pound for tomatoes in conjunction with the Fair Food Program. Ahold USA owns Stop & Shop, Giant Foods of Landover, Giant Foods of Carlisle, Martin's, and online grocery delivery service Peapod. And the lowly egg is at the center of a battle simmering in India over religious and cultural taboos against some animal products. This spring, the head minister of state in central India rejected a plan to add eggs to lunches at state-run daycares and schools. The idea was to address a protein deficiency for children in Madhya Pradesh, where the state figures indicate half of the kids are undernourished and underweight. The minister, Shivraj Singh Chauhan, is an upper-caste Hindu man who recently became a vegetarian. In Madhya Pradesh, the politically powerful Jain minority community is strictly vegetarian and has blocked previous attempts to add eggs to school lunches. Observers say the recent egg ban is part of a rising tide of Hindu nationalism that has swept the country since the Prime Minister Narendra Modi came to power last year. The free public lunch program, phased in over the last couple decades in India, has provided critical relief to an estimated 120 million children who do not get enough to eat at home. The midday meal scheme is also credited with boosting school attendance. Child rights activists say that in some areas, the introduction of eggs, a food too expensive for many families to afford, further increased attendance. Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie posted these articles at eartheats.org. Find them compiled in a list in this week's podcast post.
We talk about so much more on our Twitter feed, too. Add your two cents to the conversation at Earth Eats. Mark Chilla and our headlines.
Until next time, Annie.
The fight over food containing genetically modified ingredients is at a fever pitch. The U.S. House passed a bill limiting labels for GMO foods. But the policy debate is not over. As Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports, the battle over GMOs includes a little science, lots of money, and a food system under fire.
Free burrito. Free burrito.
A classic summertime music festival. An indie pop band on stage, long lines at the beer booth. Today, on a hot summer Saturday in Kansas City, it's the Chipotle Cultivate Festival. Sort of like a Grateful Dead concert with free burritos.
Big thank you to my main man, Marshall, for bringing us out here, and Chipotle for putting on these dope things.
Chipotle, the Mexican chain whose slogan is Food with Integrity, was the first national company to cook solely with ingredients free from genetic engineering. Lined up at an exhibit on GMOs is Julie Godshaw Linneman, wearing a flowered garland in her hair. She supports GMO labels and likens it to a problem from the past.
Oh, about like cigarettes that everyone thought it was good, and then all of a sudden we realized it was bad, and nobody really did anything until they started putting the warnings on the packaging and more people became more aware of it.
Surveys show the majority of consumers want their food labeled with GMO information, even though the world's leading scientists say GMOs are safe.
There's a lot of confusion, and it's not accidental that there's confusion.
Congressman Mike Pompeo, a Kansas Republican, is on the other side of the GMO debate from those at the Chipotle Festival. Pompeo was the sponsor of the bill recently passed by the House that bars states from requiring GMO labels.
There are a group of folks out there who have been trying to tell consumers that these foods were unsafe for a long time. They have had massive media campaigns to do that. It's been in their own economic self-interest to do that.
Both sides, all sides, however you like to think about it, have political and economic interests. They have skin in the game.
That's Carmen Bain, an associate sociology professor at Iowa State who has been researching GMOs. She points out that genetically modified food has been around for two decades. Most processed foods contain those ingredients, especially anything with corn, soybeans, or sugar beets. Still, Vermont passed a bill requiring a label on all foods containing GMO ingredients. It's the first in the country and set to take effect next July. That's exactly what Pompeo's bill is aimed at, trying to preempt the state laws and make labeling GMOs voluntary.
GMO seeds are just one of the many ways Monsanto is helping farmers sustainably grow enough for a growing world. But they're also, without a doubt, the one we hear the most about.
That's a promotional video from Monsanto. Millions from the global biotech giant, along with big food and beverage companies like PepsiCo and Kraft, were behind the anti-labeling bill. They think the labels could hurt profits. Those interests also contributed 3.5 times more in campaign donations to lawmakers than the other side, according to MapLight, which tracks money in politics. Those opposing the bill included environmental, organic, and health interests.
The issue isn't even really about GMOs.
Bain, the sociology professor, says her research shows that GMO labeling has become what social scientists call a wicked problem, one that is inherently contradictory and can't be solved through scientific fact.
GMOs is really a proxy for many of the broader social and economic and political concerns that they have, in particular about the agri-food system.
Things like corporate control and industrial-sized food production. Lori Demerit is the CEO of the Hartman Group, which does consumer research for food companies. She says GMOs have become a buzzword for what people want or don't want.
When we talk about what's sort of the number one trend or long-term change in what's going on in food culture today, what we found over the years is that consumers are really looking for products that appear or perceive to be fresh, real, and less processed.
It's our last song. Thank you guys so much for hanging out with us.
Despite what those at the Chipotle Festival may want, the Obama administration has remained neutral on the anti-labeling bill, even as it heads for the Senate. The White House also pointed out that there's already a government-sanctioned program for labeling food as non-GMO. It's called organic. And if you buy anything with that green USDA stamp, you will be eating GMO-free food. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to even more from this Midwestern Reporter Collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. A study from last year found that almost 6% of the world's croplands are located in urban areas. That may not seem like a lot, but Jennifer Cockrell King anticipates that number going up. She says if your city has gardens or farms in it, you've probably noticed.
Once you start allowing
space to grow food in cities. It changes the texture of the city.
She is the author of Food and the City, Urban Agriculture and the New Food Revolution.
And I think people are now starting to realize that it's not just a place where we put condos up so that we can live, jump in our car, drive to the office, drive back in the evening, watch TV, go to sleep.
Her book is published in English, Korean, and Japanese, which is appropriate because she's been around the world taking notes on how city dwellers are growing food. What she's seeing is a movement in its infancy. And just wait, we'll see more and more gardens infiltrating the fabric of our cities.
And we almost won't even notice it quite as much. I think the reason it's so noticeable right now is because for so long it was so absent from our cities. So I think as it becomes more integrated, it'll just be a matter of course that we'll have apartments and houses and schools and roads and community gardens or urban farms.
Urban gardening may seem like a new trend, but as she discovered, people have been growing food in cities for a long, long time. Her research into the history of the movement started back in the 1920s through the 40s with Victory Gardens. Americans were encouraged to grow food at home as a way to feel connected to the war effort and ease pressure on the country's food supply. And then King kept digging.
Going further back, Paris was a huge innovator of urban agriculture, just in the medieval times up into the 18th century and just before the Industrial Revolution. The farmers there were putting together the techniques that we now call French intensive agriculture or potager gardening or whatever you want to call it.
Most of us call it raised bed gardening. Look at most urban farming operations and you'll see these wooden boxes. She discovered that over the years and across the world, people have adapted urban agriculture to fit whatever the community's needs are. Take Ghana, she says. They're using recycled gray water to grow food. In Cuba, she noticed their urban farms are organic, not because of some ideology, but because they had no choice.
For so long, they were very food insecure, and they didn't have the chemical inputs for what we call conventional agriculture. So they had to grow a lot of food organically in cities where they didn't have to refrigerate it. They didn't have to transport it to the, you know, the consumers.
Working her way around the world, she recently spoke at an urban ag convention in South Korea. Seoul is the second largest metropolitan area in the world with almost 26 million people.
Korea obviously had to recover from the Korean War in the 50s and had a very low GDP and was very poor for a very long time. It's only really been in the last 20 some years that they have roared onto the world stage to have a standard of living that they have now. So growing food at home was out of necessity, and pickling and cooking and all these skills. And they're able to transmit them to their grandchildren, really. And I think that's what I find fascinating is it's urban agriculture allows a dialogue between the generations, which I think we've also been missing in North America for a very long time.
Perhaps so. But she is seeing hope in a project that's popping up in her town of Edmonton, Alberta. Spin farming is providing farming opportunities for young, new farmers who might not be able to afford to buy land of their own.
Which stands for small plot intensive farming. It's a really clever way of putting together little patches of front yards and backyards in a community for free for an urban farmer who wants to work that land and grow crops on it. And they essentially can canvass their neighbors for plots of land that they get rent free. And all they do in return for looking after the land and working land is give some veggies back to the landowner, which is great. So I would think that's a pretty good deal.
No land, no problem. King says the simple act of growing tomatoes in a pot on your balcony does make a difference. And it's not nearly as labor-intensive as you might think. Nature pretty much takes care of itself. Something else we can learn from nature, she says, is that we can create so much abundance with a small amount of effort.
There's always this idea that how are we going to feed the world of 9 billion people? We have to increase our output. I think we need to put on a different set of glasses and look around and see the abundance that we have already around us.
And then, of course, there's the perk of creating community. King has more conversations with her neighbors when she's working in her garden than at any other time.
You just don't talk to your neighbors anymore. You just don't have random conversations. And we seem to be comfortable talking with people around food. And so that's one of the huge benefits, is it can actually create a community and a cohesive community, because it gets people out of their condos and their houses and cars and into the streets where we actually need to be to create better cities, happier cities, more supportive cities, safer cities.
Jennifer Cockrell King is the author of Food and the City, Urban Agriculture and the New Food Revolution. You can read it in English, Korean, or Japanese. We've posted pictures of some of the urban gardens she's visited around the world. EarthEats.org. Coming up, our resident chef and his rule of Italian cooking.
It's all about the ingredients more than about the flair.
The best cheese, the freshest tomatoes and herbs, and some stale bread. Daniel Orr's Panzanella Salad. Before that, ever tried raw okra? It's a revelation in this recipe. Up next. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats, I'm Annie Corrigan. In the garden in Columbus, Indiana, Daniel is picking the freshest ingredients possible because this recipe today is raw.
And we're picking some of, look, see this okra here? It looks kind of like a finger. And actually in the Caribbean, they call it ladies' fingers. You see the flower here? It's a type of a hibiscus. So, you know, it flowers, the fruit comes right off the flower. And what you want to do is to pick them when they're really small. I like them when they're about an inch long. And that's it. We've got a nice little handful. It's enough for a couple salads here. So, here we go. Simple summer salad. Ingredients that come out of any garden that's of any decent size here in the Midwest. So we have got our tomatoes. I've got several different varieties. I've got some nice golden ones and some red zebra tomatoes. I've got some red onions, some tomatillos, a little bit of garlic chili, and the okra. We can do about equal amounts. So I would say if you have about a cup to a cup and a half of each of those vegetables, that would be fine. So we're just going to add those to the bowl. Now for flavoring, I'm going to put a few chili rings. Now these are that I'm using are cayenne, so they're these little red ones. They're quite spicy, but we're not going to use that many of them. And we're going to add a little lemon zest, which, you know, lemon zest gives you that nice citrusy, zesty taste. Okay, and we're going to finish it with the okra. Now with the okra, I'm just going to cut them in half lengthwise so you really can see what they are. I'm going to leave the little tops on them because they're so young and tender, you don't need to worry about those being tough or chewy. Now we're going to drizzle that with a little bit of honey, probably about a tablespoon. Okay, and then what's important about this salad is that you put the vinegar on, and what the vinegar does is it keeps that filmy, slimy stuff from forming. So it's very important you get that vinegar on early, right after you cut them. Okay, and we're just going to put a touch of olive oil in, a little salt and pepper, freshly ground pepper always, All right, and that's all there is to the salad. You can see it looks almost like carnival time. It's, it's so colorful and vibrant.
Gotta see it for yourself at eartheats.org. The hydroponic greenhouse at Growing Opportunities in Bloomington, Indiana, is full of row after row of leafy greens. They've only been growing food for about 4 months, so this prolific output is especially impressive. I stopped by one Thursday morning during harvest time to talk to Nikki Wooten, manager of Growing Opportunities, to find out how it works and how she cultivated new customers for this new farm.
Oh, it's not as hot as I thought it would be.
Today's really nice. So with hydroponics, it's a constant recirculation of water, and it's run by a pump that is turned on even when I go home at night. Our greenhouse is managed by a computer that will open and close my vents and turn my fans on and off and turn my heaters on and off, so I don't have to be there to hit the switch. So on the weekends, I can go home and have my free time. This is purple oak leaf lettuce, and it's really frilly and beautiful violet colors. This is more of our beautiful bib. This is what we've been primarily growing up to this point. It's what we're harvesting today. Some rainbow chard, which is really beautiful. Probably harvest this next week as well.
What are these little babies?
These over here are basil. They're pretty young. I'd say these are probably 2 weeks old. So, Bloomington's East is where we're going.
Oh, so just right over here.
Uh-huh, yeah. So, if you just turn left, we're miles. We're within 5 miles of all of our customers, and we harvest the day that it goes out. So, I told Jerome we were coming, so hopefully he's around. I've been living in Bloomington for a few years now, and so the places that I love to eat are some of the places that I went to first, and, I offered to take samples to them just so they could see it, because it's a lot different from being on the phone versus seeing it, and once you see what we have, it's instant. Like, of course, we'll order some of this, because we have such a beautiful product. Special delivery. Hi, Jerome.
Hello.
Lettuce for you. So next week we might have some new varieties for you.
Okay.
Yeah. I have rainbow chard, I think, will be ready too. So.
Oh, that sounds great, because we don't have a local rainbow chard right now.
Oh,
and
good.
We could slot you in. That'd be great. All right.
So let me give you your copy. Off with you.
And are you planning on doing this like year round, or?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
In the winter even.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got heaters, so we'll be growing year round and harvesting every week. All right.
Good work.
Will do. See ya.
Mm-hmm. And that bib lettuce she just dropped off, it's going on shelves right away. Thanks to Jerome Gust, the produce manager at Blooming Foods East, and of course, Nikki Wooten, for letting me tag along on her delivery route. Another trip into the kitchen with Chef Daniel Orr for his panzanella salad.
All right, well, we're going to be going to Italy on this recipe. Almost every culture has a way to use day-old bread. You have, French toast, which the French call pan perdu, which means forgotten bread. The panzanella salad is a perfect example of that. I've got some of our really great croutons. I'm going to add some of that, and I've baked these off with some Parmesan cheese, olive oil, salt, and pepper. But you could just use some chopped up day-old bread. Now, since these are quite dry, I'm going to just add about a quarter cup of hot water and toss those in there, and that's going to start moistening those up as I ready the other ingredients. All right, so I added 2 small rounds of fresh mozzarella. Mozzarella is going to give it that richness. It's a very mild cheese, but it has that sweet milky flavor. And to that, I'm going to add 1 medium red onion, which I'm peeling, and then I'm going to cut into julienne, which are fine strips.
Now some beautiful sun-dried tomatoes.
Yep, we're going to roughly chop those. And so what that's doing, a traditional panzanella is very, very simple. Just, you know, tomatoes, onions, basil, cucumbers, and of course the bread. But we want to have multiple layers of flavor. So the sun-dried tomatoes are going to give it kind of a deep, rich, sweet, almost raisiny tomato flavor. Then I've got our globe tomatoes, which are the big round tomatoes. Okay, to that we're going to also add some cherry tomatoes. And with cherry tomatoes, I always like to cut them in half, because when you try to chase them around the plate with a fork, they kind of shoot off the plate or they squirt you in the eye. So do you and your guests a favor and cut your cherry tomatoes in half. Okay, I've got some great basil. Now look at this jumbo basil. My mother brought it up from Gibson County, God's country.
What's her trick for growing such gigantic basil leaves?
Compost. We keep all of our green waste from preparation here at the restaurant, and we have 5-gallon buckets. We send it down to the farm. That gets composted with the bedding from underneath the chicken coops and all that stuff. Sits for about 10 months to a year, and then we can use it in the vegetable garden. Good handful of that in there, probably about a cup and a half. Now I'm going to smash some garlic, so I've got these peeled cloves. And then what I'd like to do, after I've got it pretty much chopped, is take the side of your knife, press it down there, and you're going to smash that, and that's going to bring out those essential oils and those flavors of the garlic, almost make like a paste. A lot of people like to throw a little bit of salt on there as they do that. I've got a little herb de Provence, and that has some summer savory, thyme, a little bit of rosemary. I also like to put a little bit of lavender in there. And basically now we're just going to build the vinaigrette right on top of this. We don't have to make the vinaigrette separately. Half cup of olive oil. And we're going to toss that all together. You can look and you can see these colors. I mean, it looks like an Italian flag. You got that white mozzarella, the green basil, and the red tomatoes. All those beautiful Italian colors. Now we're just going to squeeze some lemon juice over it. And then I'm going to season it with some salt and pepper. Okay, I'm going to toss that nicely. And again, of course, we're going to give it a taste. The bread's perfect. It still has a little crunch to it, but started absorbing all those flavors. It looks good. Looks like we're there.
Curious to know what you're cooking these days? Send us a couple of your favorite recipes to eartheats@gmail.com. Our team likes good stories and good food. Megan Betts, Abon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. BloomingFoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. I'm Annie Corrigan. Till next week.